This is the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel, bringing you the best tactical and statistical analysis of Liverpool FC.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's episode of Analyzing Anfield, your tactics and analytics podcast, courtesy of the Blood Red Channel. I'm Josh Williams and I'm joined by, as ever, by Dave Hughes. Dave, how's things?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you mate. How are you?
I'm good. We're looking fresher. You've got a bit of a tan on, both got haircuts. So looking healthier times, mate, healthier times. Hopefully the same can be said for Liverpool on the pitch. Obviously this is the second week in a row actually where we've recorded after what feels like a bit of a flat result, despite Liverpool generally picking up, I suppose you could label them as good Premier League wins. But it feels like Aston Villa was a while ago, so in this episode we were going to skip Aston Villa a little bit. We're going to look ahead to Leeds as well as just general other pointers along the way, really. We'll start with Real Madrid. Obviously Liverpool are now out the Champions League, sadly. But I think the tie could have worked out differently if maybe the Anfield leg was first and we'd played that first leg last night, because based on that first leg, at least it looked like Liverpool were the better team, I suppose. Simply as that, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought Liverpool were the better team. And, you know, they created enough chances to win the game. You know, it might not be captured solely in say the XG numbers, but you know, if you watch the game, you saw the shooting opportunities created. If you look at the like non-shot XG as well, it was really high, which is obviously dependent on kind of things like, you know, important actions made near the opposition's goal. I think of all the quarterfinals last night, certainly the second legs, Liverpool at the highest non-shot XG. You know, they were definitely the better side. I think on another night, a couple of those chances, you know, end up being goals. And for example, I think Josh, that one, they open a few minutes. I feel like if that goes in, it's probably going to pan out to be a different tie, isn't it? But it never, and the goal just didn't come in the end.
Yeah, and you know, this is immeasurable. You know, we can't put a figure on this, but I do think that it's very easy to say it now, but I think that for some reason in a packed stadium, I just feel like one of those goes in. I don't really know why. Maybe it's just kind of like the fans just empowering the players or just sucking the ball into the net, essentially. But I do feel like it was the exact type of performance that typically involves a Liverpool comeback in a European tie, just without the goals. And I feel like those goals can happen and more mistakes on the opposition side can happen if you've got real atmosphere in the ground. But obviously it's getting played like a training game, and it's just difficult to kind of to establish that level of intensity needed to overturn a two-goal deficit against the European three-time champion, really. It's still very much the same team. We're recording so quickly after the game yesterday. This is an 11 a.m. recording the following day, that our usual provider of expected goals doesn't actually have the numbers posted on the website yet. So I'm not sure exactly what the XG was. But I think based on other providers, less great providers, let's say, you know, Liverpool did win the battle for XG, but probably not by as much as you'd think, based on what I saw. Mm-hmm. Like Real Madrid had virtually any shots. I think they had about six or so. I'll double check that now. Shots that they did have were quite clear cut. Like you think of the Vinicius Junior one-on-one. And I think they had another quite a clear cut chance in the box as well.
They had one that deflected onto the post, didn't they?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. They had six shots, Liverpool had 15. Obviously that captures Liverpool's, I suppose, dominance on the day. Liverpool had the edge on possession as well, 57% possession. And I think just generally, despite the lack of goals, obviously, I do think the performance was really, really good. you know, it's difficult to criticise because I think Liverpool did enough performance-wise to win the game by the amount needed to progress, but we just didn't put the ball in the net.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just having a quick look now, and on average, Real Madrid have conceded roughly 8.6 shots per 90 this season, all competitions, and you know, Liverpool 15, pretty much double that amount they attempted. You know, you can't do a lot wrong really there if you creating twice as many shots against a team that normally, you know, concede roughly around 8 or 9, you're creating 15. That's good going. And as I said, just didn't seem to fall their way in front of goal. Some big chances missed by, you know, like Salah. I think Salah missed two. One fell quite big, the early one, but even the second one, you know, it wasn't a sitter by any means, but not even to get that one on target where he puts it over the bar is frustrating from a Liverpool point of view. Wijnaldum had a really good chance as well. And, you know, Wijnaldum's kind of low-key, quite clinical at times in those moments. You know, he scored some really good goals, hasn't he, from those positions for Liverpool and obviously Holland. So, as I said, it just felt like another night that could have been the kind of perfect comeback performance, really. Just didn't fall away. Here's an interesting one, Josh. What was the... I'm only going to ask you, I wouldn't normally put you on the spot on a match XG from 2 years ago, but obviously because it was a big game. Can you remember what the XG was on the Barcelona game?
I'll double check now.
Because all I'm thinking is it... Go on.
I was going to say a few of the goals were headers, weren't they? And they're generally, you know, weighted a little bit less because it's difficult to score a header in comparison to a goal with your foot. So,
yeah.
I don't think it'll be that high, but I'll check now.
I just think it'd be quite interesting, wouldn't it? You know, just to explain to people at home if the XG on that was fairly similar on the day. Have you got it in front of you now? Because I think I've got it here now.
Yeah. So it was only 1.8 Liverpool's XG against Barcelona's one.
Exactly, and you know, the Real Madrid game is going to be in and around that same figure. I think maybe marginally lower. But that just captures, you know, it is such fine margins that normally dictate these games. And in terms of the performance that was needed, Liverpool did provide it. But the fine margins, they just didn't have. You know, that being these chances going into the back of the net. And then the other factor that you alluded to at the start, where, you know, fans aren't there. And one thing I will say to Madrid, I thought they really, very rarely looked rattled, even when Liverpool were creating chances against them. There wasn't tons of panic. And whilst that's a kind of compliment to them, you'll also think, would that have been the case if it was like, you know, 50 or 1,000 and they're really down the throats? You know, would it have been as easy to stay as composed? So when you're looking at... When you consider all things, you're looking at Real Madrid, Liverpool, who are two very similar teams in terms of standards. And, you know, Liverpool started the game 2-0 down, pretty much. Well, at least a two-goal margin down. They didn't have the home support, another thing that would have been in the favour. And they probably didn't just have the rub of the green as well in front of goal. And those three things obviously impacted the results and their ability to turn the tie around.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of further perspective on it. The six shots that Real Madrid posted is the fewest that they've posted all season in all competitions. It's the only time all season that they've only taken six shots. They took 7 against Villarreal, 8 against Osasuna, 9 against Levante and Celta Vigo. But again, only the 6 against Liverpool. And... You know, the Real Madrid podcast that I appeared on last week, you know, again, I was switching DMs with the lad again during the game. And he said, it's probably the worst game of the season for Cruz and Modric. Probably the worst game that they've played all season. And although that could be a product of, you know, fatigue, you know, to face Liverpool last week, then he faced Barcelona on the weekend, now they're facing Liverpool again. I do think it was also a product of just Liverpool's counter-pressing being a lot more on point than it was last week. And I think that was part of the reason why Klopp selected the team that he did. Obviously, there was a bit of clamour around the first 11 that was selected. Thiago, obviously, on the bench. Jota on the bench. Was you surprised, Dave? Or
I was a little bit, yeah. Because, you know, just from the outset, without talking about any tactical intricacies or game plan, you think, get your forwards on the pitch. You know, Jota, who's been in really good form. I know he didn't score against Villa, but he's been in a real hot streak. You want him on the pitch. I know he didn't do much in the first leg, but I think ideally you want to try and get all four forwards on if you can. But he didn't. And then Thiago done fairly well when he come on last week.
Yeah, I think he'll have selected the team, but especially based on what happened last week. I think he'll have just picked a team that is defensively and pressing-wise really, really good in the 4-3-3. Obviously, Milner's been there since Klopp arrived at the club. Firmino has been there the same since Klopp arrived at the club. Whereas Jota and Thiago, although they might offer a bit more on the ball, they're still relatively new. And, you know, the pressing game of those two players, it's not as ingrained as it is in the other players that I've just mentioned. So I think Klopp will have gone into this game thinking, you know, if we're going to get through, we're probably going to need some form of clean sheets or at least very close to it. We obviously got that. And then around the hour mark, obviously Klopp kind of give the risk a little bit of a boost by introducing players who are maybe less defensively drilled but more unpredictable on the ball in Thiago and Jota. So I could see the issues around it, especially after, you know, needing to bring on Thiago last week after about 41 minutes. So I understood the clamour around it, but I don't think it was that as big of a deal for me as it was for some other people, especially when you consider that, you know, Liverpool have just faced Villa. Quite an intense game. We've got Leeds next. Probably the most intense team in the league. So, and we're still going for other stuff like top four. So, you know, if you're playing all four forwards, you don't want that burnout. You don't want them to pick up an injury or anything like that. So, and then the tactical dynamics of from the keeping a clean sheet perspective. So, I understood the starting lineup a little bit. Although that's just my guesswork on it. Although Klopp did mention the whole risk thing in his pre-match press conference. But yeah, I thought Real Madrid defended really well. You know, I thought they soaked the pressure really well, even though they had a makeshift back line. It's interesting that Militao played, because he's just a centre-back that I think, from a Liverpool perspective, Liverpool should be not necessarily tracking, but just keeping an eye on, because for whatever reason, Zidane doesn't seem that keen on him. You know, he always seems to play well against Liverpool. Played well against Liverpool for Porto a few seasons ago. And he just might become available. You just never know. And Liverpool need a centre-back. So, have you got any thoughts on Militao, Dave?
Yeah, it's not a bad shout. The only thing I'm thinking is, you know, how old is he now? He's still fairly... Let me bring it up. I'm just wondering if maybe... Go on, sorry. What was that?
23.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking maybe with potentially, you know, obviously that defence is, Varane's still a good age, but you've got Ramos. I don't know, maybe they're just thinking a little bit more long-term with him, but I saw a lot on social media afterwards where people who kind of, you know, heavy observers of the league are trying to say the performance was quite a middle finger to Zidane in terms of, you know, just how well he done. And a reminder that he's a good player. So I don't know if that might be the start of him featuring more for them, or whether it will just be a case of, you know, him putting himself on the radar of some top sides, and Liverpool could well be one of them. It's an option, because are you any further down the line with where you stand with, say, Kabach, for example? Have you changed your opinion from a few weeks ago when we last spoke, or are you still saying?
No, I think he's... I haven't really changed much on that one. I as I said at the time, I feel lower than most fans on him. That's not to say I think he's bad or anything like that. I just feel like Liverpool, you know, current at least English Premier League champions and stuff, I just feel like Liverpool can do better. And the reason to say that is, you know, it should always be judged on Liverpool being, in my opinion, a European giant. So if you look at Kabach, can you picture that player for Bayern Munich, for Real Madrid, Barcelona. I'm not sure on that one. And I think when it comes to signings Liverpool make, the player either has to have world-class ability or world-class potential. And he certainly hasn't got world-class ability yet. And the world-class potential box, I'm unsure on. I don't know. Do you think he takes that? I genuinely don't know. That's not me saying he doesn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And I feel like I'd want to be sure.
I get it. Yeah, I think he's definitely not a bad player, and he's still so young that it's really hard to kind of conclusively, you know, decide where you stand on it. So I do get your struggles. That being said, you know, I think he goes into a team and suddenly you go, oof, you know, that's a really good signing. Like, obviously, Canate's been getting linked with Liverpool, hasn't he? To me, that's a good move for Liverpool. I think he's going to really improve them and he's going to be a top centre-back for years to come. Do I think that with Kabak? No, not at the moment, I don't.
I think
not to say I won't be proven wrong.
Yes, yeah, I think Canate, a player like Canate, has a higher ceiling. I think that's the thing. You know what I was just saying there about world-class ability, world-class potential? I think Canate just has more potential. A lot of it stems from just the physical attributes he has on his side. He's taller, more dominant in the air, at least the same speed. So, you know, not much against Kabak, but it's just a case of whether Liverpool can maybe do a little bit better. You know, it's as simple as that. And I don't think it's a case of, you know, because he's now on loan, Liverpool should just kind of take the easy option and keep him. I think if we can identify someone who's better, you know, I'd be inclined to chase that player, or at least see how much he's being valued at. You know, I think one thing Kabak has on the side is the value attached to him. I think 18 million is quite fair, quite reasonable. So yeah, the jury's still out for me on that one. I'm not firmly in one camp, but just looking around at some of the comments made by the Liverpool fan base and stuff on Twitter, I have just looked at some of the comments and been a bit like, you know, I must be lower on than that person.
Yeah, not seeing it type thing just yet. Analyzing Anfield on the
Blood Red Channel. But one of the reasons I mentioned about Militao is because obviously Liverpool are approaching what feels like quite a big summer, and this season I have tried to remain firmly in the camp of a rebuild, a big revamp or whatever isn't really needed. And it's just this season's more of a product of, you know, the lack of fans, the lack of intensity, the lack of pre-season, the packed schedule. None of it favours Liverpool. Obviously, the injury crisis as well, massive. So it just hasn't been a great season for the things that make Liverpool what they are. So the whole revamp thing, I've tried to stay cool on. And I've been a bit like, yes, new players are needed in certain areas. We obviously need a new centre-back, in my opinion, we need a new forward as well. But in terms of selling loads of players or starting again from scratch and things, I've tried to stay quite cool on that. But having said that, when I watch games like the one yesterday, Real Madrid, although we played well, it just does feel as though you need that kind of freshness, that I don't know, that new blood, if you know what I mean.
The average age of the team last night.
Yeah, I mean, the average age of the team at the time last night, the starting 11 was between 27 and 28. It's not too bad. But the only players, I think, in the team below the age of 27, including subs, I think is Kabak. Kabak's on loan. Nat Phillips, probably not going to feature next season. Jota and Trent. Everybody else who played is 27 or over. And again, I've mentioned before on this pod, it doesn't complement well with Klopp's general identity as a coach in terms of being intense, legs, energy, vitality. the older a player gets, the less that is the case, if you see what I mean. So I don't know what you think about this whole... Have you got any thoughts on what I've just said, basically, you know, the whole revamp thing? Because I'm on the fence with it while still trying to remain in the camp of this is just a mad season. Next season, things will go a lot more back to normal, almost.
Yeah, but, you know, it could quite easily be a little bit of both, couldn't it? Because I also look at the team and just think it's not that it's necessarily really bad. It's just the mechanics of the movements and the possession play, it just doesn't feel the same. It doesn't feel as energized. It feels a little bit kind of routine, blocky. It just doesn't seem to flow the same with the same kind of penetration. I really wish, you know, I could articulate the points better, but I can't at the moment. That's the best way I could kind of summarize. You know, we did say as early as last year that this would come, this stage where it needed to change. And I'm not 100% saying myself that I think it's now, but based on, you know, if you were just trying to look at it based on what's happened on the pitch, you know, it seems could finish anywhere between, say, third and sixth, maybe. So obviously that's a drop from where they've been in over the last few years. You've already touched on the point that players are aging. I don't know, it just feels like there needs to be an injection of something fresh, just in different areas on the pitch, you know, and not just about what's happening in the attacking third, just everywhere, you know. Just I think people were hoping maybe Thiago would have brought that. And Thiago hasn't done bad at all. Obviously he's a really good player, but I don't know if he's had that kind of transformational impact that maybe people were hoping he would have had when he was first getting linked and when we talked about him in the summer. You know, kind of bringing this real other dimension to Liverpool. And he definitely brings something different. I think we'd both agree on that, wouldn't we? But I don't feel like it's necessarily been a transformational impact on the side. Maybe that's too much pressure on one player, but... maybe, yeah, to, you know, with that in mind, it's a case of bringing two, three, even four new faces in and potentially selling some of the, you know, quote-unquote old guard. You know, Sadio Mane looks really, really on the decline recently, whether it's just the fatigue, because, you know, talked about... I found a tweet yesterday that was dead interesting back in 2019, it was, so after Liverpool won the Champions League. And I'd said at the time, it'll be something along the lines of, it'll be interesting to see how Sadio Mane performs this season, because he's played well over 50 games in the Premier League and Champions League. Really highly competitive games as well. You know, you're going at it full throttle, because you remember the title race that year went to the final game. Liverpool go all the way to the Champions League final. He then went away with to the African Cup of Nations. I think he got all the way to the final in that as well and got beat. They had 2 weeks off and come back for pre-season and went and did it again. You know, Liverpool going all the way to win the title. So we had that. And then we had the lack of break and all the stuff that's come since with COVID. So he hasn't really had a break. So I'm saying he's under the climb, but maybe he's just desperately fatigued and maybe one or two other players are as well. And at the risk of rambling, which I feel like I am now, but I just think there's so many unknowns. You know, in a normal season, you could probably summarise it better, but you can't. But, you know, even if it is fatigue, then maybe you just need a shot on the arm by changing things slightly for next season.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you've just said, really. I think that's the difficult thing about this season, being able to accurately identify what the source of an issue is and being able to identify what is likely to persist next season and what isn't. And Liverpool have been really good at doing that over the past few years. I think that's where most of a club's success stems from. If a club can accurately identify what it needs to fix and it consistently keeps doing that, that club should reach a point of success because they've plugged all the holes that they needed to plug. So many times clubs end up you know, they go and buy a player that they don't really need, or they think that they need to fix this area when they really don't. And Liverpool have been great at doing that. But this summer, I think especially, is going to be really hard to do that because of the number of different things this season that's been thrown at the team. You know, I mentioned it before, but the centre-back issue, the lack of fans, the lack of pre-season, the intensity of the games has felt slower. You know, how much of that is because of the players at Liverpool and how much of that is because of stuff that is going to be on your side more next season? So it is difficult, but in particular, I'm glad you mentioned him then, Sadio Mane. I think out of everything that's happened to Liverpool, specifically since Christmas, his form is probably, I find his form as the most difficult to explain. It's it could just be fatigue, but watching him since Christmas has been really weird, really so weird, because he's just looked so far from the player, while also still doing a lot of what Mane did, if you know what I mean. Really, really weird. Like, still receiving the ball in tight areas, still directly going at his man, still clearly difficult to defend, still threatening him behind, I suppose, to an extent, but while also becoming completely blunt at the same time. And his decision-making in certain moments has been baffling. A lot less explosive in certain moments. Like, there was a little moment yesterday I thought it kind of captured his form, really, and captured what's happened to him a little bit. He got the ball on the flank and he was up against Rodrigo. Fair enough, Rodrigo was quick and he had just came on as well. But Mane kind of had the ball in what seemed like a good area, I think. And he stopped on the ball and then immediately started again. You know that stop-start that Mane can do quite well, that explosive burst of pace. And Rodrigo just took the ball off him. And the reaction of Mane, it didn't look hungry. It didn't look... It just kind of... He looked a bit defeated. So him losing the ball by not having the explosive pace in the moment, and then the kind of lack of reaction or whatever that I'm trying to capture, I felt just kind of summed up a little bit of what's happened to him in the past couple of months. But it is really difficult to capture whether it's just a decline or a decline in form or fatigue or what. You know what I mean? It's difficult.
Yeah, it's again, sounds like a cop-out, but it's just so true. It could quite easily be a combination of all those things. You know, Mane, has Mane hit 30 yet?
He's 29,
just turned. So, you know, it's more than feasible that he still has kind of a year or two at a very top level. But, you know, you'd still expect him to have 1 or 2 years at the very top, given the play he's been. But it is a concern, because I agree, he does look, at the moment, he looks a long way away from the player he is, and he's really missing him. The best way you could probably say is he's just missing the actual attacking output, I think. You know, the output that he's had as part of his game, alongside all the things that you touched on, you know, the explosiveness, ability to impact things in between the lines, all that. He's always had output to go with it. That's what made him such a desirable player and, you know, such a good Liverpool signing. But it feels like that output just fell off a cliff, and it could just be he's running really cold, as we say. But as you've just touched on, when you watch it, you see it. You see the issues. You see what's happened differently. You know, the lack of explosiveness, decision-making, it's all just out. And I don't know if that is just the cause of fatigue. It's really hard to call.
Yeah. I mean, how much of this could just be down to poor finishing? And, you know, poor finishing kind of... What's the word? It's almost contagious, really, isn't it? And if you start showcasing poor finishing, then how much of that impacts your ability to kind of stop doing your natural game? Your head drops without you even realising, almost. Just to capture this poor finishing. We have spoken about this a few times, but this season in the Premier League, He's underperforming expected goals by 5.2 goals. Last season, he overperformed by 4.2. And the season before, he overperformed by 5.9. So the previous two seasons, Mane has basically finished his shots to an above average level. This season, the complete roles reversed, complete opposite, really. And as I said, it's kind of out of nowhere. And how much of that will be impacting, you know, his mental state, his execution, his tendency in certain moments to shoot rather than pass. You know, I've noticed there was a moment yesterday. I think it was when, I can't remember who he passed to, but he got played in. It was a really nice pass. Who played him in? I think it was Wijnaldum, actually, who played a lobbed pass over the top. And he was one-on-one with, say, Militao. And I just maybe thought, you know, previous Mane finds a way to shoot there, but he didn't. He made a pass in probably in the direction of Salah or someone. So, you know, how much can poor finishing impact your game, impact your behaviour on the pitch? He hasn't stopped shooting. He's shooting more, actually, this season. I was looking at the numbers earlier. I don't know specifically in the past couple of months exactly, but this season in the Premier League, he's shooting about 3.1 times per 90. Last season, it was 2.5. So, I don't know. As I said, out of all the things that's happened this season, I find the Mane thing probably the most difficult to explain.
And it's also coincided with Firmino continuing to fall off a cliff, finishing wise, hasn't it? And Salah, I actually haven't looked at Salah's up-to-date numbers. I assume he'll still be overperforming, but he must be some distance off what he has done previously. With penalties removed at very least. Now, sometimes the numbers have it can make a fool of you, you know, making statements without looking, but Salah's
I was going to say, so Salah's overperforming in the Premier League this season by 1.1 goals. So, not far off average, I suppose, not far off normal. Last season, he underperformed by 1.2. So, for about two seasons in a row there, you'd say he's finished at average rate, you know, normal standard. It's funny there looking at his debut season. His debut season in England, he overperformed by 10.2.
What was the season after that?
Season after that, he overperformed by 2.2.
All right, okay. So he's beyond that first season where he was just insane, you know, Suarez-esque levels. It's kind of, I guess he's just been on par, but maybe it can just look a little bit worse sometimes with Salah because he does tend to take a lot of chances, doesn't he? So, you know, more than often, he'll have at least one miss in a game that stands out and, you know, that maybe sticks in your memory. But if all three players are having those kind of games on a consistent basis, then again it has a bigger impact in terms of what's happening with the team and maybe adds a little bit of pressure on each other. If, you know, in the past, if you're Firmino and know that you're missing a chance, but you've got Mane and Salah in such good form, you decide you then it's probably okay. But if all three know the other two in the trio aren't kind of converting at the same rate that they were, then maybe that adds that extra layer of pressure, which then, you know, impacts your decision making and some just little minute details like that.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
So before we move on to Leeds, just kind of sum up then, Dave, I'm going to put you on the spot. Just kind of sum up, maybe, you know, if you was in charge of Liverpool's recruitment or if you was kind of overseeing Liverpool's football operations like Michael Edwards is at the minute, how are you judging, I suppose, what has happened and what might happen moving forward in terms of, like, how you fix that in the summer window and stuff and, you know, what's your take on it?
I think in terms of answering the question on how I'd fix it in the summer window, that's tough, isn't it?
Not necessarily player-wise, but
yeah,
I mean, positions, for example.
Yeah, I get, you know, I think I think I would be looking at the team. They definitely need a new forward, I think, in there. Maybe it could be a more traditional number nine profile. And if so, that kind of might have a domino effect on how the team plays. And what I would say is, even if this has been a one-off season, with all these other, you know, influencing factors that have all impacted Liverpool's ability to perform like they have in the 2 or 3 years previously, I still believe, even if that is the case, beyond next season, you'd be in a position where you definitely would need some form of rebuild and to change things, because you're another year down the line with this core group who are going to be most 30 and above, or at least in and around that number. For that reason, I would probably start putting the wheels in motion about trying to change things, you know, even if it's only a bit more of a gradual kind of rebuild or change of direction and amendments to the way the team play, or something, you know, whatever the likes of Klopp, Edwards and all that worked up between them, that's on them, isn't it? But I would start putting some wheels in motion yet, because as I said, even if this was a one-off campaign, I think put this way, Josh, would you be shocked if Liverpool went and just kind of put in another 90 plus season next season with very little in the way of an injection of fresh faces or any sort of major change? I personally, I'll be honest, I would.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised. And when you put it like that, it makes more sense.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it, to be honest. Like, if you look at this current team next season, with fans in the ground, with Van Dijk back in defence, and an actual defensive partner as well, you know, what is the point ceiling of that team? And I don't really have an answer for that. I haven't really thought about it much. Dave just put me on the spot just then, but I don't think it's about maybe 85 to 90, is it? Maybe 85 to 95 in that region. But it's difficult to say. And I think when it comes to this sort of thing, as I said, I've tried to remain in the camp of, it's just a mad season. Next season, when you have a pre-season, when you have fans in the ground, when you have actual centre-backs playing who are very good, I just feel like things will level out a bit more. But having said that, I still think some sort of new blood is needed. And I think a centre-back's needed. I think a forward is needed. Those two at the very least. And I think some of maybe the deadwood, it's called, I think some of those could benefit from moving on, really, to raise funds for the new lads, but also, again, just to freshen the group up, just to bring in a bit of hunger, you know, those players who haven't yet achieved. So, you know, it's difficult to put a number on what winning does to you in terms of, I've now achieved everything I want to in my career. You know, is that hunger still there? You see the hunger kind of just go out of certain players' games, like, you know, Dele Alli, for example. You know, what's happened? And I don't think Liverpool players are generally like that, but the likes of Wijnaldum and Mane, they've won everything now. They've achieved everything they want to achieve. So, you know, naturally, what does that do to your motivation? So, it's difficult one. I just want to keep an eye on. And, you know, before the end of the season, we'll see how we look in terms of spaces and that podcast-wise, but we could do a transfer committee pod at some point. We haven't done that yet. Just in terms of what we would do to the squad this summer if we were in charge. So look out for that one. But back to the Premier League anyway, we still have a job to do. Still have to get top four. And we've actually won three in a row in the Premier League, but we've got Leeds United next, Dave. A team that is not an ideal side to face after you've just played midweek.
No.
It's not till Monday, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you've got basically, what, about 5 days rest, which is it 5 days? Hopefully your maths doesn't let me down there. It's not bad anyway, is it? Let's be honest. And yeah, it still looks still a really tough team to face, and probably, in my opinion, one of the most difficult teams to predict in the Premier League in terms of results, because you never know what way it's going to go. you know, you fancy Leeds to beat anyone, but you'd also wouldn't be surprised if they got beat by any side as well. I don't know if you feel the same, but you know, it sums it up really. When they obviously they beat City last week, kind of a really big result. But then they've had a few kind of high profile losses as well. Well, I say high profile against teams near situated near the front of the table, but just in terms of style, really difficult side to play, really in your face for 90 minutes, tons of pressure, and a team you kind of have to be really at it to overcome.
I didn't actually realise they've actually won three in a row, Dave.
Okay, so we'll go for
all three have been 2-1 as well. They beat Fulham 2-1. In fact, the last four results have been strong. They drew 0-0 with Chelsea, and then 2-1 against Fulham, 2-1 against Sheffield United, and then obviously 2-1 against Manchester City. So they're in what seems like a good period. And yeah, I agree that you don't necessarily know which Leeds are going to turn up. And you know, on their day they'll probably win 3-0. On a bad day, they'll get beat 3-0. And I think it's interesting how they've been playing that way all season. And the current position that they're in suggests that they're very level, they're very bang average, when they're not. They're either up here or down there, really. And what I mean by that is they're currently 10th in the league, so bang in the middle. And although they tend to score a lot and concede a lot, the goal difference is bang on zero. They've conceded 49, scored 49, so they are a really weird, unconventional team, Dave.
Yeah, I'm having a look now, and they're just a really good way to describe them. They're a very streaky side, so they tend to put together a few wins on the trot, and then they'll put together a few defeats on the trot as well. Funny enough, That point's captured by the fact that you've just pointed out they've won three on the trot. They haven't done that once so far this season. But they also haven't... Sorry, this is the first time they've done that this season, but they also haven't lost more than two on the trot either. You know, so it's very much kind of a couple of wins, then maybe a draw, a couple of defeats, then back to wins, then draws, and just very, you know, yo-yo up and down across the whole campaign. And you know, that kind of sums up, well, basically, that term that we like to use about the game being a coin toss. The things that we just flagged there, the results, the goal difference being bang on the money. I think it's fairly similar in terms of the underlying expected numbers as well. Just captures a team that you just never know which way it's going to go with them. It's always a competitive game, well, most of the time competitive game, but could just go either way, really, where they'll come out on top, or as you said, they might get a little bit of a hard.
Yeah, I mean, they've actually scored the exact same number of non-penalty goals as Liverpool this season, which is quite... felt a little bit surprising, but I suppose it's not as well at the same time. Both teams have scored 44 non-penalty goals this season. West Ham are third for non-penalty goals. Absolutely West Ham, nuts
West,
campaign.
West Ham are legit, mate.
The season's crazy. But in terms of expected goals, non-penalty expected goals per match, City top, Liverpool second, and Leeds third, well, joint third with Chelsea. So two very attacking teams, I suppose, is what I'm getting at. And on the defensive side of the game, this is where Leeds obviously fall down. If they could get their defence as good as their attack, there'd be to be competing at the really top of the league. But in terms of their defence, their non-penalty expected goals against per match ranks them 18th. According to the numbers, only Sheffield United and West Brom allow more in defence than Leeds. So it's one of them that Liverpool's attack could technically have a bit of a field day, I suppose, if they're finishing some points, but while also easily getting punished at the opposite end if the finishing isn't on points.
And the thing is that we've talked about teams who have the potential to test Liverpool's defence. I'd put these as one of them, because you know, the attack in numbers, don't they? They have good attacking players. In fact, we talked about it in the first one, and I think it was you that actually was the most vocal on it, how they tend to, you know, get a lot of players in the box, which, you know, will test any defence. It's a problem.
I'll be honest, that's crossed my mind already. It's a concern, because I remember the first game of the season at Anfield, I remember how keen they were to attack the high line. They had, I distinctly remember writing a piece, and there was an image in the piece, and it was Liverpool's high line, obviously consistent of a back four, and the back four was occupied, I think, by four or five Leeds players who were also on the last line waiting to run in behind. And now you're probably going to have that same situation, but minus Van Dijk, minus Gomez, plus Kabach, plus Phillips. So that doesn't bode particularly well. And then obviously in that first game, Leeds didn't have Rafinha, who I've been really impressed with this season, Dave. We can't possibly finish the pod without talking about him, considering the Liverpool links.
Yeah, it looks like a player with a really high ceiling. Kind of, you know, if you consider his age, I think he's about 24 now. You know, he's kind of drifted under the radar in many ways. Or, admittedly, you know, I wasn't watching him, you know, at 20, 21. I don't know if he's just really developed into a top player over these last couple of years. But, yeah, you know, he has a lot of traits that would suit Liverpool. He's already coming to the Premier League and proven that he can compete at this level. You know, really good off the ball, really good with the ball. He's got attacking output as well, which is key. Just a lot to like. And you can see why Liverpool have been getting linked with him. I think he'd be a good move if Liverpool could get him.
Yeah, I'm gonna put the spotlight on myself here. because I remember last season. Well, was it last season? It was during the first lockdown, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a year ago to around now.
Yeah, we created our alternative Liverpool 11, so we wanted the team to play exactly like Liverpool do if Liverpool's team didn't exist. And my Salah replacement was Rafinha, because he's left-footed, fast, got output to his game. And then he moved to Leeds, and, you know, he's shown that he's got that about his game, and I do really like him. He ticks a lot of boxes. He's a very, very intense player, really fast. Lots of end product to his game. I think he's a lot more creative as well than he's given credit for. His ability to execute a pass that you probably didn't see is really, really good. You know, he switches the play often and stuff. So his passing game, I think, is better than a lot of attacking players, a lot of forwards. Forwards just tend to offer the penetration, the dribble and the goals, the assists, maybe to a lesser extent. But Rafinha's really got a passing game to him. And as you said, he's only 24, so he's kind of approaching that peak age. I think Liverpool signed Salah and Mane and Firmino around the age of 24. I think Salah was 25. Mm. But it will be interesting to see if Liverpool make any sort of move there, because I'm not sure, you know, how much he'd cost. I'm not sure what a team like Leeds would demand for a player like that. You know, I'm not sure what the financial side of Leeds is like. They've only just been promoted from the Championship. But, you know, we saw Wolves, for example, let Jota go for about 40 million. You know, that I felt was very reasonable. I felt that was really fair. They could have charged us probably a little bit more. I think if it was Leicester, for example, and like a Harvey Barnes, I think Leicester would demand about 80 million. Mm. But I'm not sure what Leeds would demand.
Well, so he was bought, wasn't he, for around 17? And you think, you know, 17, if you said to Leeds, now we'll double your money, you know, 35, 40 million, I think they'd be inclined to take it, to be honest. I might get my eye wide, they might not, but doubling your money on a player who's had a really good season for you is good business, you know, and if provided he can reinvest it, which Leeds do seem to be recruiting fairly well based on what they've done recently. You'd say that could be a move that would suit both parties.
I wonder if there would be any room for any sort of swap, considering Liverpool have got the likes of Origi, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Shaqiri, specifically I think Harry Wilson maybe has been linked with Leeds a little bit in the past. I think it would be interesting if Liverpool was to offer kind of a bit of a pick of the bunch in a way. Like I think Liverpool did similar buying Jota. I think, you know, Keanu Hoover obviously went the opposite way for about 10 million. And I do think that was, that probably formed a similar negotiation. I think it was probably part of the talks. So, you know, that could be a way of getting a player like that from a team like Leeds. He's contracted until 2024. So still another 3 years on his deal. So it's probably going to be a case of another season spent at Leeds, I think, maybe before he moves to any club. But I don't know if Liverpool fancy him that much. I do think he'd offer a lot for Liverpool, specifically when it comes to, you know, any staleness, any inability to break down a block or create chances. Rafinha's just naturally a creative player, and he's also really good from set pieces as well. His set pieces are ridiculous, Dave, that time, some of his deliveries.
Yeah. And that's something that you're talking about, maybe a Salah replacement. No, so I wouldn't say that's really within Salah's locker. You know, being that good from set pieces. All right, Alexander Arnold there, but you know, if you do want to bring something different to set piece delivery, then he could. And Josh, low key as well, if you brought him in, okay, these players haven't yet got ability as high as the front three, but you know, subtly you've replaced two of the front three there, haven't you? And Jota could potentially be like a Mane replacement, Rafinha would be like a Salah replacement. And as I said, within two moves, you've kind of, it's a big task, but you've done two of three. You could obviously overtake them when they eventually get sold. So, yeah, it would be a good move.
So, thoughts on this one then, Dave? Predictions?
Really hard to predict at the moment. I cannot. Liverpool, you know, it was such a breeze last year, wasn't it? We just picked Liverpool to win every week, and they tended to do it. this year, really tough. I think it's the only thing Liverpool are playing for now. They'll be extra motivated. You know, they've kind of come back from the dead a little bit, really, because it looked like Champions League qualification was done and they wouldn't do it. But, you know, those victories have changed that. So I'm going to opt to go with the extra motivation to have something to show for the season, Champions League qualification. And for that reason, I'm going to back a Liverpool win 2-0.
2-0, you think a clean sheet?
I do, yeah, just because I wish I could justify it better, but I fancy Liverpool to do have a decent game against them.
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn on this one myself. I'm thinking there's lots of things to think about with this one, because obviously Leeds were really challenging Liverpool's high line in the first game, and Liverpool's high line is now more vulnerable than it was then. But then Leeds are quite a man-marking team. Well, they are a man-marking team. They, you know, man-mark across the pitch. And Liverpool, I've had quite varied success this season against man-marking schemes. Like, we faced Leeds in the first game, obviously, scored 4. Not long after that, we faced Atalanta and won 5-0. But then the return leg against Atalanta, we lost against Real Madrid. Real Madrid aren't as man-marking, but they are that way inclined a little bit more. And we obviously got beat by Real Madrid 3-1. And then the second leg there, that was 0-0. So Liverpool coming up against man-marking schemes, I think should bode well. And I think it will be a front three of Jota, Mane, Salah, so that they can interchange a bit more than if Firmino was playing. Because if the more you interchange, the more you cause man-marking systems problems, I suppose. But it's a difficult one to predict, because you really don't know. You don't know what Leeds are going to turn up, never mind what Liverpool's going to turn up. So I'm going to go with 2-1 Liverpool, I think. But I would not be surprised if it was 2-2. It's a difficult one, this one. I think it'll be end-to-end.
I was going to say, it's the type of game where no result would truly surprise you, would it? You know, the win, lose, or draw.
Yeah, it's what I will say. I think both teams will probably generally relish facing an opponent like this, if you know what I mean. I think Liverpool will be glad to face a team like Leeds to an extent. And I think Leeds will be happy to face a team like Liverpool at the minute, given the weaknesses that we've got. So, but I'm intrigued to see what Bielsa comes up with, because I do feel like he'll probably exploit Liverpool's problems of late in some way. He's quite good at doing that. So yeah, hopefully Liverpool will come up with a win. And we'll be back next week. So Dave, thanks for joining us, mate.
Yeah, thank you, mate. Cheers, everyone.
And yeah, be sure to tune in next week. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel.